Oh, hello everyone. My apologies. I think I was beginning and there was no sound. So let me just begin again. Thank you for welcome to our webinar. We apologize for the technical difficulties. I'll just begin with a brief introduction of who we are, JRDF and National Disability Rights Network. JRDF is a Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. We are a national law and policy center dedicated to protecting and advancing disability, civil, and human rights. Our vision is of a just world where all people live full and independent lives free of discrimination. Our constituents are people with disabilities of all ages and parents of children with disabilities. Disability rights are civil rights, and we feel strongly that healthcare rights are a vital part of disability rights. And this will be discussed further in the Olmsted section at the end of this webinar. Thank you. Elizabeth, would you like to take over?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good, good. All right. Next slide, please, Sylvia. Great. This is Elizabeth Prio, and I am on the legal staff at the National Disability Rights Network. NDRN, as we are called, is the membership association for the federally mandated protection and advocacy systems and client assistance programs. We call them protection and advocacy systems because that's what they're known as in statute, but they have different names in every state, and most commonly it would be disability rights and then the name of your state. So if that rings a bell, those are the protection advocacy systems, and we are their membership association. Our mission is to promote the integrity and capacity of the PNA and Client Assistance Program National Network to advocate for the enactment and vigorous enforcement of laws protecting civil and human rights. So if this is new to you and you'd like to hear more about the protection and advocacy system in your state or a territory, you could always contact me after the session at the address in the last slide. So I am going to begin, and I will just switch to the next slide here Sylvia actually is going to do housekeeping first. My apologies.
Hello, everyone.
Housekeeping.
Captioning is available by pressing Control and F8 on your computers. We will be stopping periodically for questions, which can be submitted through the chat function on your computer. A transcript and audio of this webcast will be posted on the website of the Aging and Disability Partnership for Managed Long-Term Services and Supports, on the NDRN website, and on the JRDF website.
Are others, I'm going to begin. When I speak, again, Elizabeth, are you all hearing an echo? I understand from Patricia Dudek that she is. Are others, just, you can all begin typing in and I will start. And if there's an echo, we'll bring in our assistive technology folks. Great, I am not echoing, so I'm going forward. As an overview of the presentation, what we're going to do is we're going to review the managed care basics very briefly, because I know you all know that. And then we are going to go over some common managed long-term services and supports concerns for individuals with disabilities and elders, and some practical solutions. Then we're going to touch on the Medicaid and Medicare non-discrimination provisions, the Federal Disability Rights Act non-discrimination and accessibility provisions. And we're going to cap off with a discussion, hopefully a larger group discussion, on the implications of managed long-term services and support in the context of the Olmsted decision, which is a decision, Supreme Court decision, which found, and this is in brief, that individuals are entitled to receive services and supports in their own homes instead of institutions when certain circumstances are met. So, next slide, please, Sylvia. Okay, again, I said I was going to go over in brief what is managed care. And the reason this is so important is because managed care is often run by for-profit agencies or even non-profit agencies, but one of the main concerns about capitation, managed care, is the capitation model, which is paying per member per month a set payment. Of course, what this does is provide incentive to serve each member as cheaply as possible in order to make the money last, as opposed to paying per member per month and spending that exact amount on each member. If it's a for-profit HMO or managed care, they're going to again want to provide as least costly care as possible. Now you can see the downside of this for people with disabilities who tend to be the most costly population. Well, specifically the most costly population is dual eligibles, those eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid services. Other reasons why this could be difficult for a person with disability, for example, is because they might need reasonable accommodations when a doctor is providing them service. And yet most HMOs and managed care organizations will have requirements for services to be provided within a certain time frame. And so if you only have 15 minutes per client, and your client, for example, has an intellectual disability and needs some accommodations, then you know you're going to go over, and then you're going to have incentives, in other words, not to provide full services to that person with a disability. And so those are just some of the concerns about managed care and capitated rates or health plans that are for profit and have incentives to provide the lowest cost services as quickly as possible. Mary Lou is going to go into much more about the concerns about managed care for persons with disabilities. It can work correctly, and we are not here to say that managed care cannot work. It's just we are here to talk about some of the ways and solutions where we can make managed care, Medicaid managed care, work for folks with disabilities and seniors. The reason I put in this slide about the managed care contract is that as advocates, I think one of the most important things we can do is look at the managed care contracts in our state. And this is a legal document that defines the scope of benefits within the health plan and the responsibilities of the health plan. And in many states, managed care contracts are still being written up and will be written up over and over in different capacities throughout the years as new managed care companies decide to provide services for folks with disabilities in your state. I just want to touch on a few of the things that a managed care contract could contain to wet your whistle as to why you want to study those, and if they're still in flux in your state, why you want to try to provide input into those documents. Just some of the things that a managed care contract would look at is what data should be collected by the managed care company. And the data could be so helpful in as far as advocates to determine whether persons with disabilities are receiving appropriate care. For example, does the contract require that the managed care organizations will report on the number of denials per month and the category of service of those denials? If we see a lot of denials of durable medical equipment, for example, or rehabilitative services covered under Medicaid, that might give us pause to wonder whether this is something that, you know, is a problem for persons with disabilities who are most likely to need durable medical equipment and rehabilitative services. Other types of data that could really help would be to report on the number of providers and the payment rates to those providers. With that data, we could compare the payment rates of commercial providers with the payment rates of Medicaid long-term care providers, and if there's a big difference, look into why that is and whether that meets the Medicaid requirement of ensuring sufficient providers. So those are just some of the things that could be in a managed care contract, and I point that out to help you, to encourage you to look at the managed care contract in your state. Okay, and next slide. The ACA, or the Affordable Care Act, is encouraging managed long-term services and supports. And that's why you all are on this call and why, you know, managed care has been a concern. We've gone to a lot of trainings for decades, but very often folks with behavioral health and long-term care needs were automatically exempted from Medicaid managed care contracts in the state. And in fact, there weren't very many states that provided Medicaid managed care. And if they did provide Medicaid managed care, it was with an opt-out provision. And yet, with the advent of the Affordable Care Act and some other programs, it is becoming more and more common for states to require Medicaid managed care with no opt-out provision for persons with disabilities and seniors. The statistic now is that of dual eligibles, which I mentioned earlier, were the highest cost Medicaid population, 58% of duals have a serious mental illness or intellectual disability, and nearly 7% of those are young adults. So when I brought that up because one of the biggest programs in the Affordable Care Act is to encourage states to do dual eligible demonstrations, which means to try to provide acute care, behavioral health care, long-term services, all under one Medicaid managed care contract. And Mary Lou will go into why that is such a concern, but again, I've just mentioned that providers don't have decades of experience serving folks with behavioral and long-term care services and supports because, as I said, Medicaid managed care contractors provided acute care and the behavioral health long-term care needs were carved out. So we're in a different situation now with the Affordable Care Act encouraging the managed care companies to provide all of these services, and yet they often don't have the years of training in doing so. So here's another program, which is basically states are using 1915B and 1115 waiver authority to expand Medicaid managed care for older adults. And I think my next slide goes into waivers. Actually, it doesn't. But the reason I wanted to put this in was because waivers, by their very nature, waive some of the Medicaid protections which are provided to folks if it was a regular Medicaid program under the state Medicaid plan. So I'm getting a little over my head here, and we're going to go to the next slide, but I did want to point out why this is such an important topic. Currently, fewer than 390,000 people, or less than 10% of Medicaid long-term care users, are enrolled in capitated managed care, which again goes to my point that while we've had managed care for years, we have less experience serving populations with long-term care needs. Change is imminent because of the programs that were just mentioned, the Affordable Care Act programs. And here, these next two bullets explain which states are currently pursuing Medicaid managed care long-term services and supports. That's not to say that they are all doing capitated plans or that they are all doing mandatory managed care plans with no opt-out provision. But you all, as advocates, what you want to be pushing for is to look at whether your programs are capitated and whether they're providing any opt-out provisions. And again, we talked about the dual eligible demonstration programs. These are the states engaged in that. So now we're going to go to Mary Lou Breslin to talk more specifically about some of the concerns for persons with disabilities and seniors.
Thanks, Elizabeth. And hi, everybody. And hi, everybody.
My name is Mary Lou Breslin. I'm a senior policy person with Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And I want to just talk a little bit about the concerns that the issue of managed care generally, both on the clinical and the managed long-term services and support side, presents for people with disabilities. It's really generally agreed, as Elizabeth said, that while there could potentially be benefits to integrating long-term services and supports and clinical services and managing long-term services and supports, there are still some substantial risks that we're concerned about. One significant concern is that Medicaid managed care organizations, as Elizabeth mentioned briefly, really lack the experience with LTSS and behavioral health. Many also lack experience with people with chronic conditions. And so according to a study recently released by the Kaiser Family Foundation, in which they interviewed numerous stakeholders from the disability community nationwide, many interesting results resulted from that survey and those interviews. Many of the interviewees feared that integration could adopt a medical model that favors clinical care over non-medical services that support independent living. The interviewees also expressed the concern that the health plans, the managed care health plans, may not view people with disabilities as experts in their own care, and only a minority of health plans thus far have included disability groups or individuals in developing LTSS capacity. Another concern is that provider incentives, such as withholds and bonuses, might create disincentives to serving people with disabilities. The strong preference among all the people interviewed for this study is that the new model should be viewed as a means to spend program money on home and community-based and other needed services as opposed to realizing savings. Of course, these are not necessarily aligned goals, and these continue to be major concerns. Diverse stakeholders in the group that were interviewed also have expressed concerns that available performance measurements focus on acute care treatment outcomes, not necessarily on quality of life or service coordination, inclusion, autonomy, self-direction, and so on, the kinds of things that we're very concerned with. There's also a concern that medical facilities and diagnostic and exam equipment are inaccessible and that informational materials aren't being made accessible to people with vision, cognitive, and other sensory disabilities, and that supports and services are not necessarily being consumer-directed. Stakeholders also have strongly expressed concern that beneficiaries enrolling in integration models may have limited access to specialists, DME, non-medical services, and so on, and that they may actually also confront hidden formulary rates. Finally, the experience with some mandatory managed care programs has shown that beneficiaries have experienced internal appeal delays and no aid paid pending. Consequently, the Kaiser study indicated that the disability community strongly supports beneficiary protections, independent ombuds programs, and these protections and the recommendation for ombuds programs is supported very strongly by most of the national disability organizations. Okay, let's go to slide 10. I'd like to just, if I could, share a couple of stories with you that really highlight the potential problems that we're concerned about. These stories concern two Medicaid beneficiaries who were mandatorily enrolled in managed care in California in 2012. Their experiences concern primarily access to clinical care. However, they still point to the kinds of problems that could arise in the rush to launch managed clinical care and long-term services and supports without ensuring an adequate infrastructure that takes into account the issues and concerns I just mentioned. Let me just begin by summarizing the problems that the woman whose name is Marta encountered. She's a 61-year-old. She lives in Los Angeles, and she's a Medicaid beneficiary, and she's also a person with a disability. She just struggled with one issue after another, being mandatorily enrolled in managed care. She has rheumatoid arthritis that left her totally dependent on her husband for all of her needs. He feeds her, helps her go to the bathroom, bathes her, helps her sit up. She's a wheelchair user, and she needs assistance from him even to hold her head up and talk on the phone. She requested that she be allowed to continue seeing her long-term rheumatologist, but she had tremendous difficulty obtaining a medical exception that would grant this request, at least temporarily. After her initial request was denied, she sought some legal representation. Continuity of care was granted, and her arthritis doctor agreed to continue treating her. But despite the guarantee of a 12-month extension to be able to continue seeing her old rheumatologist, once the approval was obtained, she was told that it was only good for 3 months. In addition, she needed to continue cortisone shots at least twice per three-month period, and very frequently monthly. The plan only authorized her for one office visit in 3 months in order to address her pain, which had been documented by her physician over many years. She had to pay out-of-pocket for care beyond every three-month visit. She appealed this decision and requested an expedited grievance, which was denied even though she was entitled to this kind of an expedited response. In the end, she was left with the choice of paying for her appointment or enduring her pain. All right, let's just talk a little bit about the next example on the next slide. Marlene is a woman who lives in Santa Monica, California. She's 62. She lives on SSI. She has thyroid cancer and severe damage from radiation, requiring treatment by an oncologist, a neurologist, and an endocrinologist, a neurologist, and an oncologist. She was mandatorily enrolled in managed care after the doctors at her clinic were unable to continue treating her through the continuity of care request. By the time Marlena sought legal help, she was struggling to get connected to doctors and had gone without care for almost 6 months. She wasn't able to see any of the specialists the plan had referred her to during the six-month period. One of them was located in a city that required her to travel 100 miles round trip, even though she didn't drive and didn't have a car. The plan's response was that they offer transportation, although not in this case, because the transportation is only good for a 25-mile trip. The plan referred her to an endocrinologist. She waited for an appointment. When she got there, she learned the provider was an obstetrician gynecologist who did not practice endocrinology. The plan's response was that it was an appropriate referral because some providers have dual licenses, even though it acknowledged this provider does not. As a result, she went without care for over 6 months. Now, while these examples don't include managed long-term service and supports problems, the same types of issues could easily arise for our LTSS beneficiaries, particularly for those with worsening medical conditions that could lead to increased need for long-term services and supports. And this raises the question whether managed care organizations will be responsive enough in real time to catch these individuals before they wind up temporarily or permanently in institutions. Okay, let's just take a look at the next slide. So what are some of the lessons learned, at least from the California experience? Well, one of the most key lessons is that the implementation process needs to provide adequate time for beneficiaries to make informed decisions about plan options. Of course, there's many different configurations of managed care and managed long-term services and supports, but the key is a slow phase-in that ensures that beneficiaries have opportunities to really be informed about what's going on and to the extent possible be able to make reasonable choices. And the second big issue and big lesson learned in California was that many beneficiaries lost long-standing relationships with their providers, and they have these disruptions in care have been very detrimental to their health. And changes in treatment came about, which should not have come about if continuity of care was really the goal. Okay, let's take a look at the next slide. Let's just look a little bit at some possible practical solutions here. These are drawn from a number of sources, including another Kaiser Family Foundation report that summarizes, obviously, some of the main steps that need to be taken to sort of offset some of these anticipated problems. Obviously, phased-in enrollment over time with break mechanisms is one of the key elements that needs to be in place. Plan relationships need to be mandated with community-based groups and provider organizations and advocacy groups. Additional assessments, provider network, continuity of care, and out-of-network care also needs to be provided for. And managed care standards need to be developed that are suitable for populations with chronic conditions and disabilities. Capitation and reimbursement rates need to be set that incentivize deinstitutionalization and appropriate home and community-based service levels rather than reinforce institutionalization. Long-term services and support specific quality measures and quality improvement methods need to be based on real-time monitoring as well. Okay, let's just take a look at the next slide. There's three reports that we want to point you to for those of you who are a little newer to this material than others of you. The three reports point to the fact that managed long-term services and supports in the relating to quality measures are not yet available at the national level. And these reports provide some guidance to states and advocates and suggest some measures for consideration. One of them is produced by CMS and provides some guidance to the states for those using 1115 waiver demonstrations. The second report is produced by the National Quality Forum, and it presents some preliminary quality measures to CMS for managed long-term services and supports programs. And the third report is one that was written by staff from DREDF and from the National Senior Citizens Law Center. This is a guide for advocates that identify and to help identify and select long-term services and supports outcome measures. Okay, with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Sylvia.
Thanks, Mary Lou. And I hope that echo is taken care of now. We're going to go on and look a little more closely. We're talking about civil rights. We're looking at non-discrimination. And it seems that what non-discrimination means seems to evolve somewhat in the context. Looking at managed care and looking at managed care in a Medicaid context, what has non-discrimination meant? In Medicaid law, managed care contracts must prohibit discrimination on the basis of health status or requirements for health services in enrollment, disenrollment, and re-enrollment. That makes sense. So people with disabilities can't be not enrolled or disenrolled arbitrarily. And federal law has also put requirements on the extension of matching federal funds for the provision of Medicaid in states. So medical assistance must be provided statewide, and states must use reasonable standards for determining eligibility and the extent of medical assistance. So as an example, the amount, duration, and scope of a service must be sufficient to achieve its purpose. There should be no discrimination based on condition. For mandatory Medicaid services. And there has to be comparability among similar groups and between medically and categorically needed persons. So as Elizabeth, I'll go quickly through the next slide. As Elizabeth has mentioned, these fundamental Medicaid rights can be amended. Can be waived. My echo is that. I'll try to speak through it, but if okay. So it's possible for a state to obtain and provide Medicaid in a way that waives certain requirements, statewideness, for example, comparability and financial eligibility requirements. If a state wants to undertake a demonstration, it can do so for a subpopulation within the state and not necessarily then provide those services statewide. So that has to be approved by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, and it should be approved for limited time periods. And there also is a requirement to meet state assurances to protect health and welfare, including the adequacy of providers and state licensing and certification requirements. So this is part of non-discrimination under healthcare law. How does that interact with what we think of in the disability rights field as ADA civil rights or Section 504 civil rights, non-discrimination? Let's look at the interaction of a common managed care organization regulation and non-discrimination under, let's say, the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's pretty common for states to have a requirement of adequate capacity and services manifested as time and distance standards. For example, a requirement that a managed care network has to have primary care providers that are available within X miles, I just arbitrarily said 10 miles here, or within 30 minutes. And that's intended so that everyone who gets Medicaid services is able to reach a provider. There's an additional complication of, is that provider actually taking patients? And that's an important complication. But there are also specific complications faced by people with disabilities who require a provider. The usual time and distance standards don't really encompass physical and programmatic accessibility, for example. So for someone who's a wheelchair user and needs accessible exam equipment, what if there is no provider within 10 miles or 30 minutes, no Medicaid provider that actually has the equipment that would enable them to have a fully effective exam? And this is not just a possibility, it's a probability, given the degree to which providers don't have accessible equipment. I mean, that there's height adjustable exam tables and weight scales that can take people with wheelchairs. Is the 30-minute distance requirement something that is 30 minutes by public transportation, given the degree to which many people with disabilities rely on public transportation or do not drive by themselves? Are necessary specialists covered by the same criteria, or is it just a primary care network that is subject to the criteria? Does the provider network include critical specialty treatment centers, which have developed an expertise over many decades and relationships with people with chronic conditions and disabilities? So this is how, looking at this interaction, there is sort of the managed care regulations that have developed over time, when managed care primarily applied to healthy families and children, and then how are those long-standing protective standards, how do they relate to the kinds of non-discrimination that people with disabilities specifically have a right to? Turning now to Medicare and looking at the managed care non-discrimination requirements there. Plan sponsors may not discriminate based on race, ethnicity, national origin, religion, gender, age, mental or physical disability, health status, claims, experience, medical history, genetic information, evidence of insurability, or geographic location. So that's a very, I'm not reading everything else on there, and as I said, the slides will be available. But that's a very, very broad statement. Non-discrimination on any of these bases. And that's also something that has been around for a long time, this non-discrimination requirement. It is taken from Chapter 3 of the Medicare Managed Care Manual, and Chapter 3 is on the Medicare Marketing Guidelines for Medicare Advantage Plans, Medicare Advantage Prescription Drug Plans, and Prescription Drug Plans. Managed care and disability non-discrimination. Managed care has had a long presence in Medicare. It's not something new to managed care plans in Medicare that they're subject to non-discrimination. And yet, if it comes right down to it, how much familiarity do managed care organizations have with the federal and state disability discrimination laws that they are subject to and that they are subject to in the provision of long-term services and support? Despite the fact that there are non-discrimination provisions in Medicaid and Medicare laws and mentions in the handbook, there has been little attention paid to putting actual policies and procedures in place concerning reasonable accommodations and policy modifications. And this is one of the fundamental rights under disability discrimination law. A person with a disability has a right to reasonable accommodations and policy modifications to get a service that is actually effective, to get effective health care for themselves, equally effective health care. They have a right to effective communication. And none of this can be made without proactive front-end staff training and awareness of the need to put policies and procedures in place. It isn't it isn't quite the same as just, well, you have to let them in the door. Because letting them in the door doesn't guarantee an effective service. In Medicare, the federal government and HHS Office of Civil Rights has more direct control and oversight, and yet there is still no history of proactive and systemic enforcement of disability non-discrimination among Medicare managed care organizations. Our experience is that the Office of Civil Rights investigates individual complaints against particular providers, and they will enter into investigations at times and take complaints against larger entities like a county or a state, especially where there is a clear or particularly egregious violation of rights. But we don't know of HHS monitoring and enforcing accessibility and reasonable accommodation by managed care organizations and providers taking place as a regular component of enforcing a plan's contractual obligations. These seem to be very separate things. And managed care organizations in general are familiar with contracts, the parameters of their contract, and they're familiar with concepts of customer service. But they're not necessarily familiar with the concept of disability civil rights. This is just a very brief look at LTSS components and Medicare, and I just wanted to cover this because usually Medicare doesn't cover long-term services and supports. But on occasion, Medicare can do so when the managed care organization that's offering Medicare includes as its package long-term services and supports. And it could be items like dental, vision, routine hearing care, or personal care or custodial care or non-emergency transportation. So to the extent that Medicare Advantage plans actually cover long-term services and supports, our thought is that they should also be subject to the non-discrimination requirements that all Medicare organizations should be, all managed care organizations should be subject to. This is some of what was covered in part one of this webinar series, but we just wanted to go through this again quickly. Federal disability laws and managed care. ADA Title III covers all places of public accommodations and includes specifically the professional office of a healthcare provider, a hospital, or other service establishment. There could be some argument that a managed care organization is not in itself the office of a healthcare provider, but I think it's very clear, especially as managed care organizations take on specific service obligations of their own, as they take on the obligations of being providing care management and providing a bridge between different services, that they are a healthcare service organization. They are under the obligation to not discriminate on the basis of disability, and that should include the obligation to make reasonable accommodations and policy modifications for themselves in their customer service offices and in their own complaint procedures. If someone requires effective communication, if someone requires alternate formats in the materials, in the health plan materials, that is a health plan's own obligation. They're obligated to provide auxiliary aids and services and to ensure that architectural barriers are removed, that they achieve readily achievable removal of architectural barriers in their own offices. Now looking at ADA Title II, now an entity can't be subject to both Title II and Title III. Title III deals with public accommodations, which include for-profit and non-profit managed care organizations. And Title II applies to state and local government entities. But when a state or local government entity enters a contract with any private entity to provide an aid, benefit, or service of the state or local government, The government entity must ensure that the contractual functions are carried out in compliance with Title II of the ADA. So the thought is that that if Medicaid, including long-term services and supports and home community-based services, that Medicaid does not lose its character as an aid, benefit, or service of the state just because the state chooses to implement its functions through contractual arrangements with managed care organizations. It still remains an obligation of the state. The question is, though, that does this then mean that the Title II, the weightier Title II obligations, are then placed directly on managed care organizations? Perhaps not. But if the managed care organization's contract with the state or federal government obligates the managed care organization to meet standards of non-discrimination that are the same as those required of the state, then any gap between government services as provided by the government or by non-government entities could be bridged. But that's something that has to be actively imposed. So it can't be that the federal government or the state just says to the managed care organization, oh, you have to meet your own ADA obligations, your own federal or state disability non-discrimination obligations. It would be a very clear provision that you are required to meet the standards of Title II in carrying out your provision of Medicaid services. And looking at the next slide, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. This is a critical federal law that applies to federally funded services and to federally conducted services. So it covers Medicaid agencies, corporate and nonprofit managed care organizations that take Medicaid or Medicare payments, contracting provider groups, and individual providers. It's a lovely requirement here that any entity, so any managed care organization, cannot directly or through contractual arrangements provide any aid, benefit, or service that denies people with disabilities the opportunity to participate in or benefit from Medicaid, affords people with disabilities an opportunity to participate or benefit from health care services that are not equal to that afforded others, or provides people with disabilities an aid, benefit, or service that is not as effective as that provided to others. So this is something we feel very strongly about that applies, and applies not only to the managed care organization as its own entity and its own member services department, for example, but also filters down it and applies to, let's say, how it recruits and maintains and oversees and monitors its provider network, including specialists. That this is something that they have to actually be aware of. Who in your network is accessible? Who in your network provides effective communication and knows of their obligation to do so? The last section I want to look at is the federal financial aid recipients are also prohibited from using methods of administration that have the purpose or effect of defeating or substantially impairing accomplishment of the objectives of the recipient's program or activity with handicapped persons. And I wanted to bring this up, looking specifically at methods of administration, because the whole devolution of how Medicaid services are provided, it seems often to be growing increasingly complex. The goal of integration is to provide the individual Medicaid or Medicare recipient with services that are more seamless. But often the stream of responsibility seems to be growing longer and longer and longer, looping from the federal government through state governments, through counties, and through managed care organizations who then further subcontract with other service providers and with provider groups. Through all that stream of responsibility, you have a method of administration that grows increasingly complex, and it's very hard for an individual recipient to show, well, where did the breakdown? I know I'm not getting the service I'm supposed to be getting. Or I know that I'm getting a service that that I'm being discriminated against because I can't get access to my service. I can't get on my table. I can't get the extra time I need or that my family member needs. I can't get an appointment where anyone listens to me. I can't get an ASL interpreter. Where does that breakdown happen? And it seems with a long line of administration, increasingly easy for the finger to be pointed and for nothing to actually be done. So that's I'm not aware of this provision ever having been used in this context, but as managed care entities increasingly enter the field of Medicaid and Medicare, and especially in long-term services and supports, areas they're less familiar with, it's important to keep this in mind and to see if it has potential application as we go forward. The last part I'll be looking at is also the newest part. This is Affordable Care Act's non-discrimination provision. And I'll spend a little more time on this and also tell you all about an opportunity to comment on this, which is happening right now. Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act provides an individually enforceable new authority to prohibit discrimination against individuals with disabilities in applying for health insurance and accessing health care services. So it applies the Civil Rights Act, the Age Discrimination Act, and the Rehabilitation Act, including Section 504, which I just looked at, to any health program or activity which, one, receives federal financial assistance, including credits, subsidies, or contracts of insurance, two, is administered by an executive agency, or three, any entity established under Title I of the Affordable Care Act, which includes the healthcare marketplace and exchanges. So looking at this, the Affordable Care Act, Section 1557 can be said to clarify that a managed care organization is absolutely subject to federal civil rights laws, and Section 504 in particular, and that it has to proactively comply with these provisions. There's nothing here about a place. It doesn't need to be a place of public accommodation, but it's absolutely an entity which receives federal financial assistance when it's administering Medicaid or Medicare. If it's taking federal dollars or state dollars to provide long-term services and supports to people in the community, it is subject to the non-discrimination provisions of Section 504. There is a provision in Section 1557 that says the Secretary shall not make coverage decisions, determine reimbursement rates, establish incentive programs, or design benefits in a way that discriminates against individuals because of age, disability, or length of life. And furthermore, the Secretary is to take into account the healthcare needs of diverse segments of the population, including women, children, people with disabilities, and other groups. And there's some clear implications here for data collection. The Health and Human Services Secretary can't take into account the healthcare needs of populations or subpopulations that he doesn't know much about. And unfortunately, people with disabilities have not been included in data collection efforts, federal and state data collection efforts, to the degree that they need to be. If people with disabilities are not identified, if they're not identified as a group, then the fact that their healthcare needs are not met is not recorded anywhere. Excuse me. And that would be a critical problem. These provisions lose their punch, lose their applicability for people with disabilities unless people with disabilities are identified and identified to a sufficient extent to know what their needs are, what they need for accommodation. And also, finally, the Health and Human Services Secretary shall ensure that health benefits established as essential not be subject to denial to individuals against their wishes on the basis of the individual's age, expected length of life, or the individual's present or predicted disability, degree of medical dependency, or quality of life. This applies a lot to the exchanges, and while it's not not on the on the topic of the public programs, we just want to note that there has been a lost opportunity for in the exchanges for that the promise of essential health benefits being equal for people with disabilities has been lost in some degree because of how benchmark plans, excuse me, my apologies, I've been subject to coughing lately and it seems to have come back, that the essential health benefits in each state have been allowed to pick their own benchmark plans. And in some states, those benchmark plans include historical limits on benefits. And as far as we know, it seems like those historical limits, such as, let's say, an annual cap on the provision of durable medical equipment and the degree to which that will be reimbursed. Let's say a $2,000 or $3,000 cap on durable medical equipment, that cap would be entrenched in the benchmark plan instead of being disqualified as a discrimination. So this is the opportunity for comment on the Section 1557. The U.S. Health and Human Services Department, the Office of Civil Rights, has put out a request for information on Section 1557, specifically on Section 1557. And disability discrimination is a big part of that. They want to know the landscape of disability discrimination in healthcare. So we do really want to encourage advocates and people with disabilities to comment, to speak up with your own stories and your own examples of what discrimination in healthcare has meant for you, how you have experienced it, and what it has meant for the state of your health, the maintenance of your health, and your own ability to remain in the community. We'll be going on to the Olmsted discussion, which is important, but we are drawing this line. Your capacity to get the healthcare you need in the community is obviously critical to your remaining in the community, and your right to remain in the community has been recognized under the Americans with Disabilities Act and by the Supreme Court. So this is a very important opportunity for you to go on. I've seen the comments that have already gone there. They're just a few short ones so far. The deadline for comment is the end of the month, September 30th. There have been something like 5 comments that individuals have put up about their own experiences, ranging from LGBT discrimination to sexist discrimination, etc. So I really do encourage people with disabilities to speak up about their experiences and to enter a comment. And with that, I'll turn it over to Elizabeth, who will go on to the Olmsted discussion.
Thank you, Sylvia. And before we go on to the Olmsted discussion, I'd like you to turn it back for us to slide 24 or 25. Really, I wanted to discuss the application of these ADA and Affordable Care Act non-discrimination provisions to managed care companies specifically. And I wanted to talk about 3 important areas of case law that are important to note when we talk about anti-discrimination. The question being, is it the state's responsibility to ensure that the managed care company does not discriminate against persons with disabilities in their denials, in their due process provisions? Do they provide appropriate notice to folks when they say that in their coverage decisions, for example, is it the responsibility of the managed care company or the responsibility of the state that is contracted with the managed care company? And one of the reasons I wanted Sylvia to put back this slide is that it talks about the Affordable Care Act non-discrimination provision. And in there, it specifically says that basically the state cannot contract away its responsibility to comply with anti-discrimination provisions. And this has been upheld even beyond the Affordable Care Act, but in other contexts, for example, in an Olmstead discrimination suit, can the state say, well, or a Medicaid Act discrimination suit, can the state say, well, I am not responsible for ensuring that the healthcare provider's offices are accessible because, you know, the managed care company is responsible for ensuring that. And there's a series of case law which has said absolutely not. You cannot contract your obligations for doing that to the managed care company. There's some great language in different legal cases. I'm so sorry, that's my phone and I can't take the time to turn it off right now because I'm talking. Another area which has come up in case law is, can managed care companies appeal a decision which a state has decided not to appeal? For example, one case in the Fourth Circuit, the issue was, had the managed care company complied with Medicaid notice and appeal provisions prior to cutting services. And in this situation, it was the state it was the managed care company itself that had terminated the service, and it went all the way up to the Fourth Circuit, and the judge said that the service should not have been terminated, that prior authorization was used inappropriately in this situation, and the state decided not to appeal. In this case, they wanted to appeal to the Supreme Court. But the managed care company wanted to appeal the decision. And the Fourth Circuit said, in this context, the Medicaid managed care company cannot appeal an adverse decision. That when the state Medicaid director chose not to appeal, that was the work of the single state Medicaid agency making a decision. And the Medicaid Act requires every state to have a single state agency that runs the program. And if we allow managed care companies to appeal even when the single state agency hasn't, that does not work. So those are two areas where I think it's really important to mention how managed care interacts with the anti-discrimination provisions. One other decision that came up as well was, can a managed care company use its copyright protection to refuse to turn over medical documents in a case that involves a managed care organization? And the court has said, if the state contracted with that agency to provide Medicaid services, then they cannot refuse to provide copyright-protected materials as long as they are related to medical necessity, and that's the question before the court. So that's the context that I just wanted to mention. Now I'll go on to the Olmstead slides. Thank you, Sylvia. I think those began on slide.
There's been one question I just thought I would bring up here. Does the ACA have any effect or impact on VA medical services?
good question for us to bring up. And again, I'm going to go quickly so that we can have time for us to put in questions. But I want to encourage people to right now type their questions into the chat function. Even if it's questions related to the Olmstead provision that we haven't gotten to yet, go ahead and type them in, and that way we can start right away with our questions. We also have a moderator in case you're not by your computer and you want to ask a question by phone, you can do that as well. So the Americans with Disabilities Act, you all heard of me refer to the Olmstead decision or the ADA integration mandate. Basically, it stems from the provision in the Affordable Care Act, which says no qualified individual with a disability shall, by reason of such disability, be excluded from participation in or be denied the benefits of services, programs, or activities of a public entity or be subject to discrimination by any such entity. And the Department of Justice was responsible for issuing regulations to interpret that provision, and they issued a regulation which everybody calls now the Olmstead regulation, because that this regulation was the subject of the Olmstead decision, or they call it the integration mandate. And it basically says that persons with disabilities must receive services in the most integrated setting appropriate to their needs. There are a couple limitations. To save time, I only really put the most important limitation here, which is that the ADA requires states to make reasonable modifications to avoid discrimination. They are not required to make fundamental alterations to the nature of the program. So in the context of Medicaid, the state could argue that if they had to run their waiver in such a manner where they couldn't cap waiver services, they could say that's a fundamental alteration to the way we run our waiver program, and argue that that should not be considered a reasonable modification under the ADA. So next slide, please. So what did we expect after the Olmstead decision? We all call this the Brown versus Board of Ed for the disability community, because it basically says that if a state is providing some services for individuals in the community, then an individual that's living in an institution cannot be forced to reside in that institution to receive services that the state could otherwise provide in the community. And there's a test and all that, and you guys are pretty familiar with that. But after the Olmstead decision, we expected a shift of residents and Medicaid and state dollars away from institutions into the community. The theory being that it's a limited pie of funds available for long-term services and support. So in order to make a robust enough array of home and community-based service options available, then there would have to be some downsizing or closure of institutions so that some of that money could shift away from institutions into the community. And you would definitely need a vaster array of home and community-based services so that individuals with very high service needs, you couldn't argue, well, you can only get those in an institution. You should not have to argue that. You should be able to find an array of services in the community that can meet even complex health needs. We expect to finally see a community bias within Medicaid. This is playing on what we normally call the institutional bias of Medicaid. When Medicaid began, there was not a culture of providing services in the community, and the basic premise of Medicaid was that folks would go into institutions, and if you were eligible for Medicaid, you had an automatic right to institutional care and no such right on the community-based level. We wanted that institutional bias to switch to a community bias, and as I said before, we wanted to see the downsizing and potential closure of institutions. So next slide, please. So how does Olmstead relate to managed long-term services and supports? Olmstead itself does not change Medicaid law. basically it establishes that state Medicaid programs must operate in ways that comply with OMSCEP. You all might have heard of the New Freedom Initiative, which came out a couple of years after OMSCEP, and that was a declaration by the executive declaration that all of the federal program, all federal agencies should look at their programs and determine if things needed to be done to ensure that those programs, including Health and Human Services, complied with OMSCEP. So that's really what we're getting at, that, you know, Medicaid law can't operate in a way that would violate OMSCEP. So more than half the cost of long-term services and supports today are financed by Medicaid. That's why we focus on it so much in this context. But there are some inherent tensions between the OMSCEP mandate and the manner in which Medicaid funds its long-term services and supports. We already talked about the institutional bias. I touched on, and Sylvia touched on, this reliance on home and community-based waivers instead of state plan services. We talked earlier about how there are certain provisions of the Medicaid Act that ensure sufficiency of services and supports to achieve their purpose, things like statewideness, equal access to services, and some of these fundamental Medicaid provisions are waived when you receive a Medicaid waiver. And I could go into the whole background on waivers that started with a girl named Katie Beckett, I get so excited telling that story, it would take me too long. But I just wanted to make the point that so much of our home and community services are funded by waivers that's automatically a disadvantage. And basically, we have funding that's based on setting and not the services provided. So that in itself is a problem. It's like, well, if you need institutional-based care, then you can access a waiver. Well, what if you don't need institutional-based care, but all of the services that you need match exactly what is otherwise provided I'll take a specific example, traumatic brain injury. Often folks with traumatic brain injury need a very similar set of services as those with a developmental or intellectual disability, depending on how their TBI manifests itself. But unfortunately, the individual with TBI would not be eligible for that developmental disability waiver simply because of the diagnosis and/or the setting in which the services of the waiver are to be provided. And then you have a bias towards medical orientation. When they determine medical necessity, they're not really looking at whether the service enables an individual to participate in the community. Parents and family members and attorneys have to go through all sorts of loops to identify the medical necessity of a service that they want provided, which in fact the goal is to enable participation in the community. And it's just a shame that those kinds of issues aren't being looked at, but that's again where we need to have some long-term care quality measurements that hopefully CMS is developing, and hopefully we can look at some sort of quality of life information as opposed to the strict medical orientation of a service. So next slide, please. So I just want to look at some of the areas in which Medicaid could be implemented in a manner that would cause discrimination under the integration mandate. And basically, it's providing services beyond what a state currently provides under Medicaid may not cause a fundamental alteration. Providing services beyond what a state currently provides under Medicaid may not cause a fundamental alteration. And the ADA may require states to provide these services under certain circumstances. For example, I talked before about if it's a fundamental alteration in the state, if it may say they don't have to do it. But there are very many circumstances where a state can claim fundamental alteration, and in those situations, the state would be required to provide reasonable accommodations in order to facilitate an individual to live in a community rather than in an institution. So here are some of the ways where it could be considered a reasonable accommodation to enable somebody to either remain in the community or move out of the community, move out of an institution in order to receive services. Expansion of waiver slots. We all thought that this would be a shoo-in after Olmstead. In fact, the case law rarely requires it. There have been a few situations where the courts have said, yes, you must expand your waiver slots in order to comply with the ADA. But mostly we get expansion of waiver slots when a case has been filed and the state has settled the suit. And when they have settled the suit, what most states will agree to do is expand their waiver slots in order to facilitate the movement of individuals from the institutions to the community. Another reasonable accommodation could be lifting of caps on service hours. This has been an exciting area of success in the context of individuals with very significant mental health needs who had been served under a waiver. All of a sudden they turn 21, they go under the adult program, and they're not able to get the level of service hours they need because of that are subject to the caps. And the argument is, well, state, you had been providing these services to the individual all the way up till yesterday when they turned 21. So how can you argue that it's a fundamental alteration to now start providing them? In this situation, the way that it's worked is for young adults who have such severe disabilities that you're not talking about floodgates here if the policy has changed. You're talking about individuals. In fact, most of the situations, cases that have worked are individuals where you can actually make the case that if the person moves to a nursing home in order to receive care, they are likely to die because nursing homes just can't provide that level of care. But it is an exciting level of cases, and I want to make you guys aware of what we call these aging out successful suits. And then another area where you might try to, as a reasonable accommodation to prevent unnecessary institutionalization, would be to bar cutbacks in Medicaid, home and community services. And this is a very hot claim right now, as states are just emerging from their tight budgets, and so many of them are trying to cut back on their home community services. Usually, it's not so obvious as the states say, well, we're going to cut services by 20%, like in sequestration on the federal level. Usually, it's much more hidden. Like the state might say, oh, well, we're going to try this new assessment tool for determining how many hours you're eligible for Medicaid. And their new assessment tool just happens to come out that you lose 30% of the hours you have been receiving. So those are the kinds of cases, and it's been mixed. In some cases, they said, yes, it would be a violation of Olmstead to cut back those services because it puts folks in the community at risk of institutionalization. In other cases, not. And the last type of claim you could make under Olmstead would be a method of administration claim, where because of the way the state runs its policies, it's leading to a preference for institutions over the community. One area which was very exciting where this has occurred was a case called DAI, or DAI, Disability Advocates Incorporated versus New York. And then the Department of Justice actually intervened and became raised a claim as well. And the state, the argument was that New York was basically relying on boarding care homes as their main type of community-based setting. And so they were able to make the argument that if New York is relying on these boarding care homes as its main method of community integration, they're basically creating a preference for institutionalization over community because they're not making enough community-based services and instead moving folks directly from state hospitals to these board and care hubs. So, last slide, and I want to leave time for questions, so I'm not even going to go over the last slide, but I'll just point you to the fact of that you can look at Olmsted settlements and pick out some very clear items that are in every settlement, and I will touch on some. Supported individualized housing. Most settlements are moving away from this idea that you can build a six-bed group home, call that community, and by the way, let's put them all together in a little village because it's much cheaper to build them that way and all look the same. The settlements lately have been saying supported individualized housing. They've looked a great deal at assessments, how they're determining whether a person's ready for the community or not, putting in strong transition requirements and community follow-up, peer services, consumer-directed support. Another big area where the settlements are all looking at lately are does an individual have access to supported, customized employment, or are they living in the community and then they're sent to their sheltered workshop all day long, and then back to the community where they're living on their own. Diversion, of course, is usually part of every settlement, and strict quality management and data collection. So now I'll stop and we can take questions. Sylvia, do you want to handle, or actually we would just ask our moderator to do that. Mr. Clark, our moderator, do you want to open the line so people can call in with questions?
Oh, well, I'm just looking through the chat. I think I will be providing any questions.
Okay, so Sylvia will start with some of the questions from the chat room, and if you want to call in, do we have that option, Sylvia?
We don't have the...
We have a moderator.
Call-in capacity.
Oh, never mind, I'm calling in. So Sylvia is going to lead us through some of the chat room questions. There's still time to add yours.
Mr. Clark is our captioner.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Clark.
I actually do not see chat questions at this point.
I see some of you there. I see Alan Bergman, for example. He's a managed care guru. Alan, ask us a question or make a prescient point for us. And while we're waiting for that, other people, you don't have to be prescient, only Alan does.
So it would be wonderful if we answered all your questions.
I seriously doubt that. Does anybody want to share their thoughts basically on how Olmsted and managed long-term care will or will not jive? Here's a question, right? Or a couple of questions. Sujata has a question. All right. Okay. So Sujata asks, do you have any tips on how to handle denial of pain management services? Managed care plans complain that there is significant fraud in pain management requests. Well, just the use of fraud makes me want to mention a paper that the National Health Law Program did on different ways of addressing issues with managed care organizations. And one of the ways that they have written out and talked about in one of their latest fact sheets, which you can get on their website, are use of Medicaid anti-fraud provisions. And they have talked about how individuals have had some success with actions making federal False Claims Act claims. And they mentioned a few. And so that might be one way, but it's basically the idea that imposes liability on a managed care organization for knowingly making or using a false record or material statement to obtain payment from the government. So if they sign a contract and aren't meeting the requirements of the contract, that could be a possible claim. Do you have anything to add there?
No, I actually wanted to bring up an earlier question that is also been added to, which is in the chat. I have to find that, because it is very applicable. Apropos, and I'm quoting now, of disability rights. Elizabeth, while I'm reading, could you turn off your talk, because I think that leads to the echo.
Oh,
absolutely.
Thanks. Apropos of disability rights, I have concerns about the fact that the California Department of Healthcare Services, the state agency in charge of managed care, has not been very good about understanding their own obligations under the ADA. They don't have an ADA coordinator. And when I worked in the city of San Francisco's ADA compliance office, I tried unsuccessfully for over 6 months to get them to have a phone line for deaf callers. The phone numbers they list are voicemails from hell, interminably long waits till you to leave a message, and would be impossible for anyone with a TPY to navigate. They repeatedly refused. If this agency doesn't even understand their own obligations under the ADA, how can they be trusted to oversee civil rights obligations of the providers? And the subsequent remark on that question was, finding that, I was struck by the earlier typed point re absence of an ADA coordinator or auxiliary communication options from the state healthcare agency. Has there been any litigation on this issue or any additional guidance from CMS? I'm going to turn myself off for a second if you want to talk about that first, Elizabeth.
No, I didn't. You can answer that one.
Okay. Litigation on it, it's been, yeah, and there was, I'll link this to another question, which was, you know, how do we get our states to take on more of this litigation, which I think I'll take as how do we get more of this litigation against our states. I think that is a really critical one, and I have to say it's CMS has, I have not noted that CMS has been a really big leader on this in terms of coming in at the very top and saying, oh look, our federal money is going out, joining with the state money. We expect that all along the line you're meeting your disability access requirements. It's not something, I mean, the monitoring goes on all up the line. I don't know the extent to which, I don't think there is that much extent to which CMS is actively overseeing states to ensure that state agencies are meeting with their federal obligations to provide access, or even their own state laws to provide access. And it's certainly not it's not an encouraging situation at this point. So what I'll repeat now, I think that the fact of all this activity, the fact of so much going on in terms of healthcare reform, so much attention being focused on standards, does provide an opportunity to re-emphasize again. And it's a very time-intensive and laborious thing to have to be popping up and saying, oh, access, you need to have access standards. You need to have real ways of monitoring. You need to have transparency over what you find when you do your access reviews. And these entities, managed care organizations, counties, whatever the subcontractors are, they have to tell you, they have to report on their accessibility and their provision of effective communication aids, et cetera. That becomes a whole structure that has to be put into place, and then that's something that we can really, really push on now, because if it's not put into place, then it becomes something that's just ignored. and people with disabilities who have these needs are slipping through the cracks.
And so, yeah, now that I've had a chance to think, I do have a few more comments. I echo exactly what you're saying, and you're basically saying we are the ones who have to ensure this happens. The opportunity to do that is right now. We included the link to comment on the regs regarding access under the Affordable Care Act. Another option is, and if you, you know, when we say comments, it don't have to be very formal. You just have to, for example, you know, if you have one example of how you went into a provider organization and they didn't have a TTY, if you have comments on how that could be fixed, or just putting your voice in that this is an area that CMS really has to focus on, then this is the time to do it. Another reason why the time is so ripe is because CMS has just issued its training requirements for the navigators and in-person assisters certified application counselors, who are the different groups that are supposed to be helping folks when they, if you have somebody who is currently uninsured, they would go on to the healthcare marketplace as part of the Affordable Care Act. And in this healthcare marketplace, they would be able to find out several things. One, are they eligible for Medicaid? Two, are they eligible for CHIP? Three, are they eligible for any tax credits for private insurance if they have to go that route? And four, if they're eligible for private insurance, private insurance options are there under the marketplace? So, and basically what they're hoping that people will do is either use a website, which I don't know, it's called something like Marketplace or, you know, something, or go use these certified application counselors, navigators, calling them to, and so what CMS has asked for is what kind of training do these navigators need to have? Right now, the training for navigators is you know, adequate, but there's no training, the training for in-person assisters basically does not include a provision on the ADA requirements, literally. So, you know, there's going to be many more in-person assisters than they're going to be navigators, and yet the in-person assisters don't have training on the ADA required. So those are the kinds of things where we really have to speak up and say, hey, everybody needs this, not just navigators. And I know that they have gone to some disability rights groups in order to determine what kinds of training needs to be met, but I hope this encourages you all to get involved and realize, you know, that CMS is making these decisions right now, at least as it comes to the marketplace programs, and we really need to be at the table. Just one more example. I've gone onto the marketplace website. They've kindly at CMS has reached out to various disability groups and asked for their comments. And you mentioned TTY. There is right now, there is very small listed a TTY number, but the 800 number and the chat line number are very prominent. So it would be very easy for them to include a TTY number in a prominent way, and they just haven't. And I think it's because they haven't heard from folks with disabilities.
So everyone, we really appreciate your bearing with us as we had a slow start, and also your sticking with us for the end as we wind up. Thank you for your questions and for your attention. We do think this is a really vital topic. If states and managed care organizations are not catching some of the most obvious requirements, like having a TTY line or effective communication, the more sophisticated requirements of Olmsted, what it means with regard to the provision of long-term services and supports, are easily going to be lost.
But Sylvia, there was one more question. Are we on? I mean, if you guys don't mind, I don't see a lot of people signing off. Can we try to answer this one last question?
Sure.
Okay. Oh, the TTY?
The Melinda in the center is struck by the earlier type point regarding absence of an ADA coordinator or auxiliary communication options for the state healthcare agency. Has there been any litigation on this issue or any additional guidance? As I said, there is guidance on how the affordable that they just issued on how the Affordable Care Act would have to comply with these requirements, and I can post that up right after this is over so that we can, you know, so that you can come right back on, sign back on, and get that. Did you have any other suggestions of things that we can post to help with this question? I imagine there's been some litigation, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. How about Sylvia or Mary Lou?
I think there's a whole broader question in terms of litigation, litigation on TTY, but litigation on effective communication, and then litigation on how much the state monitors ADA enforcement amongst all of the subcontractors. That one I don't know of.
I do know that provision would be monitored by the Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights, so that would be the first place to go to look as to whether they have any open cases. And I also know that the National Health Law Program has done a wonderful piece. Mara Udelman there has done a wonderful piece on ensuring access of the marketplace for persons with disabilities, and it mentions, you know, all sorts of ensuring that all sorts of different auxiliary communication options and the like are available. And so anyone who is particularly interested in ensuring their managed care programs are up to snuff and are really serving folks with disabilities in this way should go on and get that managed care marketplace guidelines, or it's called checklist for marketplace accessibility for people with disabilities. And I think it's a beautiful thing to just bring to your state and bring to your navigators and say, hey, have you done this? It'll knock your socks off. But then again, I'm a friend of Mara, so I guess I might feel a little biased.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth. I think we will be calling this webinar to an end. Again, thank you everyone for your participation. And the transcript and the slides will be available online in the three locations that we've indicated earlier.